Support for this program comes from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Helping you discover the Twin Cities, it is Radio K's Real College Podcast, online and on the air. My name is Matthew Kudis, and this week we are telling stories of diversity and achievement in spite of an unbalanced playing field. We are in the midst of many momentous social and cultural movements, with Minnesota rising to be an important stage for these changes taking place. It is widely known and scrutinized that Minnesota isn't the most diverse state in the US, nor is it the most equipped to benefit people of color. Though, as we hear on this week's show, there is hope and progress for equal treatment and opportunities to prosper. David Leem profiles a political candidate unlike anyone else, and Max Fuller explores the lack of diversity in Hollywood. Also, we hear the word on the street with Patrick Sharkey, and Radio K's weekly release spotlight. And all starts right now on the Real College Podcast. As the presidential debates have raged, covering important issues such as race, women's rights, immigration, and refugees, a local Cedar Riverside politician has launched a campaign for state representative for District 60B. If she wins, she'll be the first Somali-American woman to ever win political office in this country. David Leen has more.
The American dream has come to represent the social mobility and opportunity promised to every citizen. Natural-born Americans take this promise as a given with our citizenship. But for those outside the U.S., it is the reason to pursue that citizenship. I recently got a chance to talk to a woman named Ilhan Omar, who is running for state representative from the 60B district of Minneapolis. This district includes the University of Minnesota campus and neighborhoods such as Como, Marcy Homes, and Cedar Riverside, where Omar has lived for the last 15 years or so. Her family, like innumerable others, left their home to pursue the promises of American citizenship that we take for granted. Here, Omar will describe how her family's pursuit of the American dream shaped her own choice to pursue political office.
A lot of immigrants come to the United States looking for the opportunity to achieve the American dream. And that, I know it's a cliche, but you know, and it means a lot of different things to a lot of people. But to my family, it meant that our kids were going to be able to have great education. It meant that we were going to be able to thrive economically. It meant that we were going to be free of fear and prejudice in living in a free, democratic, and just country, right? My name is Ilhan Omar, and I'm a longtime resident of the West Bank. I am a mother of three children. I work in the area of recruiting women to run for office. So I work for an organization called Women Organizing Women Network as their director of policy and initiatives. And I love the idea of democracy and volunteerism and people having equal access to the people that represent them. I came from Somalia, so we fled conflict and a civil war. Back when I was 8 years old, I had spent 4 years in a refugee camp in Kenya. And we've been here since I was in sixth grade. So I think like when you are eight and everything that you know is taken from you and is shattered and you have this extreme sense of insecurity that surrounds you, you tend to become extremely resilient and you tend to be very appreciative of the opportunities that you get going forth. So I try to make sure that there are no opportunities that are lost and that you know, that tomorrow isn't promised, that we must do what we can today so that if we don't make it to tomorrow, someone else has a better tomorrow. So I started out sort of getting involved in politics because of my grandfather. When I was about 14, I used to go with him to caucus, and I was sort of like his cultural and language translator. He came from Somalia, where he had a brief window of participating in electoral process and in an actual democracy. And so he yearned for that. And when we arrived here, he was very much excited about taking part of a process that allowed every single person to, regardless of what class they were in or what race they were in or what their gender was. As a Somali woman in Minnesota, it's meant that as a Somali, these are certain things I should care about. But the reality is that I am more than that, right? I'm a mother, I'm an immigrant, I'm Muslim, I am Black. And I don't get to choose which identity that I worry about more and fight for more. But what it mostly has meant for me in Minneapolis is that I'm able to relate and speak to a lot of people because of my intersectionality. There's a lot of conversations about what reflective democracy looks like in a representative democracy. And it's often not really about a particular identity. I think it's about having people that speak to the concerns that you have, people who have, you know, fluency in the issues that you struggle with, people who are not going to be allies in your struggle, but are part of your struggle because they face all of those adversities or have overcome all of those adversities. And I think it's about more about the journey in connecting with people as a relationship person and as a bridge builder. And that's sort of been me in that, you know, I speak to a lot of our diverse community here in District 60B, and I feel so deeply connected to the people here, and I feel so deeply enriched by their diversity in culture, in education, in concern, in activism, that I want to embody all of that, and that I want to walk with them and work with them and be able to represent them in the Capitol. And I hope, you know, I get that opportunity.
You can find out more about Omar's campaign, as well as the campaigns of her opponents Mohammed Noor and Phyllis Khan, at their respective websites, and I'd really encourage you to do so. It's up to you to decide whether you support her politics or prefer her opponents. But as a candidate who would be only the third Somali-American and the first Somali-American woman to be elected if she wins, Ilhan Omar and her pursuit of the American dream speak to some of the core issues of this election cycle. From Minneapolis, this is David Lean for Real College Podcast.
Hello, you're listening to the Real College Podcast. My name is Matthew Curtis, and I'm joined by David Lean, producer of the show. How are you doing, David?
I'm fine, Matt. How are you?
I'm great, man. And we just heard your story on Ilhan Omar, a candidate for state representative. First things first, why is she important to this election?
You know, you should really look at her policies yourself and make your own decisions. I'm not endorsing. But just from, you know, looking at the entire political arena right now, there really is no one like her. I mean, she will be the first politician of her kind if she wins. She will be the first Somali American woman, and I think one of the first Muslim women as well. I don't know for sure, but definitely at least one of the first, if not the. So that's pretty historic, whether or not you agree with her policies or not.
And you said in the story that she's running for District 60B. Can you explain what that means?
60B is the name of the district that you and I and Radio K are currently sitting in. So District 60B is a district in northeast Minneapolis that makes up both East and West Bank of University of Minnesota. It also includes Cedar Riverside, Seward, Marcy Homes, Nicollet Island, and some of Como. And so it's a very large, incredibly diverse district, demographic range in any number of different categories across the district. And so it's a harder one to kind of run for.
A quote that I found to be very interesting was about her identity. She's a woman, she's black, she's Somalian. She represents the intersectionality of this district within herself.
Yeah, you know, Omar has really tried to be very present in not just her communities, but all the communities that she is running to represent. And I think, again, it's that thing of she is, as you said, like that she is the physical representation of a lot of these intersectionalities.
And the fact that she's from Somalia, how does that affect her campaign and her outlook on American politics?
For those of us that grew up in America, we have like this very specific conception of politics and that kind of thing. But I think that someone like Ilhan Omar and a lot of the community that she represents, specifically the Somali immigrant community, that promise of, you know, America, of why they came here, means something very different. And there is an optimism that is actually kind of striking in comparison to, frankly, a lot of the cynicism that's really kind of defined this campaign cycle. You know, that thing of her having the experience of not just being born into a system that she can take for granted is very much like it makes her a much more unique candidate in comparison to a lot of them in this campaign, you know.
So who is she running against?
So she's running against two other candidates, both Democratic Farmer Labor Party. All three are Democrat. And so the incumbent that she's running against is named Phyllis Kahn. She is the longest serving member of the Minnesota legislature. She's been there since 73, 74, as we see often with career politicians. You know, she's settled into her position. The other non-incumbent candidate that Omar is facing is named Mohammed Noor, who is an educator and community activist, also from Cedar Riverside. He is also Somali American. If either Omar or Noor win, they will be only the third Somali American ever elected to American political office. Both of their predecessors were also from here and are both currently serving.
So what kind of narrative are we seeing in the context of the election being in Minnesota?
It's one of those things where to outsiders, it might be surprising to hear that, you know, these candidates are running from like Minnesota of all places. But Minneapolis actually has the second largest Somali immigrant population in North America after Toronto. There were a lot of conversations last year about how do we frame narratives about Minneapolis? Because The Atlantic came out with a piece basically saying that Minneapolis was the best place to live in America for white middle class millennials, like people who are going to go into business and tech. It's great for them, but we've been duking it out with Wisconsin for a while as to who has the worst racial and ethnic disparities in the country. That's another thing that the candidates like Omar and Noor can speak directly towards because they experience that. So that narrative of, you know, what does it say about Minnesota that these politicians are coming from here and running here? It's not a blithe statement to say that things are better here for these people, but they do still experience a lot of these oppressions, but they still have that hope and that optimism that the promise of these places, so the promise of America at large and specifically of these so-called, you know, liberal havens like Minneapolis, you know, they see that. They see the fact that it's falling short. They don't buy into the myth, but they do buy into the promise.
Earlier, you talked about Omar not wanting to take things for granted in terms of the American democracy. One of the biggest things is voting. Can you speak more to that?
Yeah, you know, and this is a big topic now that this is an election year. And, you know, you hear all the time, oh, I just don't vote. It's not going to make a difference. But the thing is that it's something like 2/3 of the entire American population does not vote because they think it doesn't make a difference. And it's like if they all stepped up, again, I'm not advocating for Omar or Noor or Khan, but I will say get out and vote, actually participate in it, because that's something that is a huge part of a democracy. It's something that we shouldn't take for granted, and it actually really does make a difference.
Hey, everybody, it's your boy P. Patrick Sharkey here once again to bring you this week's installment of a little segment we like to call Word on the Street. Word on the street is that the one, the only, Bruce Springsteen's making a stop in St. Paul at the XL Energy Center tomorrow, Monday, February 29th. The Boss has been touring the country as part of his The River Tour, where he plays the entirety of his 1980 record, The River, front to back. And I just so happened to be going to the show with my dad. Thank you, Dad. Bruce is 66, and he's going to play for 3 hours, and I could not be more excited. Here's his song, Hungry Heart, off of The River, and I will see you tomorrow at the XL. Word on the street is that Minneapolis' own Polisa is doing a 3-show stint to kick off their nationwide tour here in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area this Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. Wednesday, they'll be at the Turf Club in St. Paul. Thursday, they'll be at 7th Street Entry. And then, to cap it all off, Polisa will be headlining in the main room at First Ave on Friday. Here is Dark Star off their 2012 album, Give You the Ghost. Star is playing the Turf Club on Thursday, March 3rd. This Austin, Texas-based band put out 2 records in 2015. The most recent, Pure Mood, was released just this past November. And this song, Guilt, marks the halfway point of Pure Mood and is certainly a standout from the record. It's really, really, really good. Make sure to check them out on Thursday, and perhaps I will see you there. And lastly, word on the street is that Ben Folds will be playing a very special show with the Minnesota Orchestra at Orchestra Hall on Saturday, March 5th. Here's Ben's song, Not the Same, from his debut solo record, Rockin' the Suburbs. Well, that's all we've got for you on this week's Word on the Street. Be sure to check out these shows and all the other great ones going on in the cities this week. For more information, you can always check out RadioK.org. And for Radio K and the Real College Podcast, I'm Patrick Sharkey, and thank you for listening.
It's not 1928 anymore. Shows like Amos and Andy, which relied heavily on black stereotypes for laughs, are no longer on the air. But then again, it hardly feels like the 21st century in Hollywood's portrayal of African Americans or the opportunities presented to black actors or actresses. New reporter Max Fuller examines why the film industry is still lacking in the diversity department in 2014.
The year is 2014. We have a black president, black secretary of state, Oprah's still black, Flavor Flav's black enough for all of us, and yet I bet you still probably can't name more than five black actors.
All right, Denzel. All
right. Probably even less black directors and writers. In fact, according to the 2014 Hollywood Diversity Report, only 7.6% of major motion picture writers are black. And only 5% of the directors of major Hollywood films in the last 5 years have been black. Just for some perspective, the NHL, that's right, the National Hockey League, arguably the whitest sport in America next to water polo, has a higher percentage of black people playing hockey than Hollywood does directing or writing movies. Not to mention, when black people get an opportunity on camera, the roles presented to them are a little limited.
The only role they gonna let us do is a slave.
And the Oscar goes to 12 Years a Slave.
A butler.
I'm Cecil Gaines. I'm the new butler.
Or some street hood or something.
I'm a gangster, Grandpa, and I'm proud of it.
See what I mean? Now you might be thinking, why exactly is the film industry like this? I was thinking the same thing.
Hollywood is very conservative. That's why you keep seeing 30 reboots of Batman and Superman and Spider-Man, because they would rather go with something that's been tested than try something new, even though they depend on something new to keep people interested.
That's Catherine Squires, a professor here at the University of Minnesota that specializes in race and the media.
You know, we have a reboot of Star Trek and a reboot of Star Wars, and we have, you know, characters from various Marvel comics that keep coming out, right? And since all of those characters are white, right, that means that even when you remake something, you still have smaller possibilities. So that conservative impulse further undermines the position of people of color who are trying to break into the business.
And unfortunately, Hollywood didn't just get like this overnight.
Hollywood and TV have done this for years. They've capitulated to racist fans. Whether they were worried that movie theaters in the South wouldn't play something that had Sidney Poitier in it or what have you, they've capitulated to that. And so even though the audience is much more diverse and more global, there's a lot of research that shows that the people who are making these decisions are still assuming that there's going to be this kind of racist backlash. So the way they calculate these things is always on the very conservative side, and that's a problem.
How come the only black movies Hollywood wants to make are ones with black mammies in fat suits? Yeah.
Or black women in pain, man.
So basically, we got black people dying in the past and black people dying in the present.
That was a clip from Dear White People, a satire about the black experience at a majority white college that is a little bit too relatable to my life right now. The film, which was shot here at the University of Minnesota, by the way, was written and directed by a black man named Justin Simeon and contained a majority black cast, a rarity in Hollywood in 2014. I got a chance to talk with Marquis Thompson and Brandon P. Bell, two actors from the film, on their experience as black actors in Hollywood.
Do you guys feel like you ever get like sought out or casted in specific roles that are traditionally only for black people?
I mean, me personally, like, no. In terms
no,
of,
yeah.
I mean, if you know, both of us, we go out for tons of stuff, different kinds of roles, and we haven't been, I don't feel like we've been placed into a box. And so
we're not that famous yet.
Despite all of the current racist trends of Hollywood, Brandon and Marquis just didn't seem to be affected. Brandon even went as far as to say,
I'd say there's benefits of being a black actor and there's not. I mean, at the same token, we've talked about this before. If you're a white guy in Hollywood, there's 9 trillion of you. Good luck. For minorities, you can almost name the actors by hand. It's almost more advantageous to be an African American because there are opportunities.
Well, that's great, right? Maybe things aren't quite as bad as we thought they were. But other black creatives don't feel quite as rosy about the state of the industry.
Unfortunately, there's not a whole lot of balance when it comes to our content. Like, when I say our content, man, like, you look at, like, most of the content or stories or shows and movies that are about black characters, there's not a lot of range, meaning you don't see, like, a Harry Potter in the hood.
That's Carl Jones, the head writer, director, and animator of Adult Swim's Black Dynamite, an animated parody on the blaxploitation genre set in the 70s about a bad mother shut your mouth named Black Dynamite that fights the man and the powers that be.
I just got one thing to lay on you cats and then I'll split. That I am declaring war on anybody who sells drugs in our community.
But Black Dynamite, I sell drugs in the community.
Carl talked to me about the unique pressures he faces being a black creative behind the camera.
All the responsibility and the pressure falls on the one show that does have a platform where they can be critical on black people. They also are held to a certain standard, and people expect you to show all different sides. You know, and you may not be able to do that.
We would never, ever say to a white middle-class man that he's not doing a good job of presenting all of the different variations of white middle-class life. Woody Allen can tell all the stories about New York that he wants, but he's telling a story about 6 blocks of New York, rich white people who live on the Upper East Side. But people talk about his stories as having a universal appeal. But when Spike Lee makes a movie about 6 blocks in Brooklyn, people expect him to, like, solve the race problem.
Unfortunately, we won't be able to solve the race problem here either, but that doesn't mean that it's impossible. As you can see, just from the small sample of people that I talked to, this issue is incredibly complex. Despite their differing views on the industry, Catherine, Carl, Brandon, and Marquis all agreed that not only do we need black people telling black stories, but we need intelligent people telling a diverse range of stories in general. So here's to hoping that Hollywood catches up with the times a little bit and starts seeing the world in a little bit of color. And if not, there's always Black Acting School.
Black Acting School!
For Culture Q, I'm Max Fuller.
And that concludes this week's Real College Podcast. Thank you to David Lean, Patrick Sharkey, and Max Fuller for contributing to this week's show. Our producers are Max Fuller, Patrick Sharkey, Jackie Renzetti, and David Lean. And you can find us on RadioK.org, iTunes, and on Sundays at 6 p.m. on Radio K. Support for this program comes from the Minnesota Arts and Culture Heritage Fund. And thank you for listening.